Welcome to the Path of Reason. My name is Adam, and this is podcast number 5. Joining me tonight is Derek Jones, the co-founder of pathofreason.com, and also Joe Holman from ministerturnsatheist.org. Thanks for joining us, Joe.
Thank you. Glad to be a part of it.
Just to get things started, if you could just give us a brief background on your story as a minister turned atheist.
Okay. Well, I went to seminary, began seminary in July of 1995, graduated in July of 1997, and from there on went into the ministry. I was in the ministry for 9 years, and at 4 different churches in the Churches of Christ, had a rich experience, a very good experience, but over time, I began to see that I did not believe in not only the Church of Christ, but in any religion, and that I gradually defected. And at the end of those 9 years, was a full-fledged atheist. And in 2003, I resigned from the ministry. And not much longer, here we are today.
Wow. Yeah, Derek and I have gone through similar deconversion stories like the one I read on your site and stuff, so we're right in the same boat with you as far as that goes. Didn't exactly make it to ministers, but I actually taught like religious ed and in the Catholic Church and that sort of thing. So
yes, there's quite a number of ministers, and even current ministers, some of whom are fairly well known, have reached out to me and have confided in me their doubts and have expressed, and there's a lot of people like yourself that were, you know, almost there and then decided just beforehand, you know, to not go through with it. So
right.
Main thing is there are doubters that in all walks and positions that are ready to defect. And it's very common nowadays.
Right.
A common thing I hear at the hospital I work at, from, because we have a couple of nuns, and they know that I'm an atheist, and a lot of them say that they doubt, but they feel like the people they know, they rely on them too much, and they feel like they would be ruining a lot of people's lives if they walked away.
I have heard that. I have heard similar things, not only from nuns, but from priests and personal evangelists, that they have shared with me their doubts, and then they said, well, I'm just going to stay with it because I think it would disappoint too many people.
Yeah.
And plus, it's a way to earn a living, too, which for like those mega churches, I think even if they were convinced that there was no God, they'd still, you know, continue on.
They would survive simply for the profit.
Right. Now, actually, not to get too personal or anything, but on your website you say that even after your deconversion, your wife was still a Christian. Now, I know that Bart Ehrman, who says he's agnostic, says that his wife is still a believer as well. Now, does that cause any conflict in your relationship, and is there any preaching that goes on back and forth?
Well, I should have made a mention of the fact on the site, and I have had so many requests for this, and currently I'm doing a series of articles on it, but I didn't mention on the site that my marriage ended in 2005 from all of these complications.
Oh, I see.
And I was prepared for it to continue, and then but the schism that in a household with a staunch believer and an unbeliever was too much. Granted, that wasn't the only difficulty in the marriage, but that was the main difficulty, and it eventually took its toll, resulting in a divorce. But I'm having a series of articles on how to deal with the family, and often this question is mentioned in connection with that. People will ask me, well, how's your wife? How do you deal with it?
Right.
And it's a very difficult question. There are no easy answers, but all that. It is an incredible conflict. It depends on the nature of the fundamentalist, whatever type of fundamentalist Christian is living with said atheist,
right,
and to what degree that person is expressive. So it just depends. And often, more often than not, when I am contacted by people in this situation, the marriages tend to suffer greatly, if not terminate. And that more often than not, that tends to be what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky because when I talked to my fiance throughout my deconversion, it just made sense to her. So, I mean, I can't imagine being in that situation, though. That's got to be rough. You've either got to convince the other person, or the other person has to be a more liberal-minded person, I guess.
Correct. You can't imagine it as the, unless you're there. And you, it's, you know, the love-hate relationship aspect of it, the bitterness that it creates, the tension, the difference of views. It's almost as though, you know, you're no longer acquainted with the person you're with in certain ways. It is extremely, you know, difficult. It's one of the most difficult things. And in my book that is to be released, Project by the Truth, A Minister Turns Atheist and Tells All, I go into detail more on the marriage and more so than on the conversion, the deconversion story on my site. I go into on more detail on how that, one of the biggest problems or one of the biggest weighty matters in deconversion, if you're married, is that, hey, you know, I'm not only letting down God, I'm not only letting down my brethren in the church, but I'm letting down my spouse who counts on me to be there. And so that factored heavily into a lot of the pain in deconversion.
Right. And I think that's an issue that's not really addressed that much. So I think that people will really benefit from that.
Yes, and I've gone ahead and apologized to my listeners for not having more, I guess, if you will, how-to articles on dealing with family and arguments, and which are such a big problem for newly defecting agnostics and atheists,
right,
because these are big issues. And when you've never been religious, it's different. Or when you've been religious and then you've deconverted, and then it's been a number of years, you tend to forget. But when a person is very religious and defects, the people around him, if they were counting on him as a spiritual mentor, then for that person to defect, that's going to cause tremendous waves.
Right.
It's going to cause unbelievable friction, and there's a lot to know on how to, on what to do, what not to do, and so forth.
Yeah, definitely. Now, some people claim that ministers turned atheists are essentially trading Christian fundamentalism for atheist fundamentalism. What are your thoughts on that claim?
And I have dealt with this. I have dealt with those comments from so many people,
right,
through the years. They will write and they will tell me, you're just trading off one form of a belief system, if you will, for another.
Mm-hmm.
But that is entirely untrue. And the reason it's untrue is when it comes with understanding why that's not the case. I guess a little part of it has to do with human nature. I tend to be, admittedly, a person of extremes.
Hmm.
When I got into the ministry, it was a full-on deal. You know, Jesus died for me, so I'm going to live and preach for him.
Right.
Well, then when I left the ministry, a part of me tended to take back those tendencies with me to where, you know, hey, this is false, get out of it, you don't want to believe it. But there are also fundamental differences between atheists and of course, an atheism, as you know, is just a default position. It is not a positive affirmation of something.
Right.
When a person becomes an atheist, they are not, they don't have a religion. They don't have a doctrine of positive ideals to force on anyone. But at the same time, and I speak personally as well as for others whom I know, what I seek to do now is to bring my experiences as an atheist, a deconverted Christian minister to an atheist. I seek to bring those experiences to others who are in my position or similar positions, and share the knowledge. What should you say to your family? What should you say to those around you? How should you deal with the stress and the heartache and the worry and the pain brought on from believing or going through a belief that you're going to go to hell, that you're going to be tortured, and that a deity is going to make you suffer because you turned your back on it? That doesn't sound like much to a moderate believer of sorts, but it does. It is a very significant thing to someone who is struggling in their faith.
Right.
So in answer to the question we're dealing with here, the main thing is I want to take my experiences now as an atheist and make them available to others. I'm not proselytizing. I'm not trying to get anyone involved in a sort of church or anything like that. I want my experiences as a deconverted atheist to be valuable to others.
Right. Basically just sharing your experiences with people who care to listen.
Exactly. Right. I have no desire to argue, and as far as that, if that were the case, if I did, if I was looking to somehow make atheist converts, as far as the term goes, I would be in forums and in chat rooms debating this person. I don't do that. And sometimes I get invited. I get a lot of young 17, 18-year-old atheists who say, well, come join us in this forum and let's debate these Christians. Well, I have no desire to do that. I have no desire to make a convert out of someone who finds their happiness in Judaism or Christianity or any branch thereof, because that's not my goal.
Right.
My goal is to make my experiences available to those who are in a position and are inclined to receive them.
Yeah, and I think that's what Derek realized recently with debating people. Because, Derek, you were going back and forth with some people through email, right?
Yeah, and I just realized that after a while, it's almost like it's pointless. Because never seem to make headway, because I've made headway with people, but after a while, they just start not responding, or like, especially when it comes to like evolution and things like that. Like, I merely just want to educate people, and I usually, when I do talk to them or debate them, I try to set like ground rules, and I'm like, listen, I'm not trying to destroy your faith, but I want to set some things straight. So like, you make a claim, and we'll discuss it back and forth, but I'm not here to, like, you know, change your beliefs. I'm merely just trying to fact check, in a sense, because obviously, I mean, I'm sure you realize there's a lot of, like, misinformation about atheism, science. I mean, the whole broad spectrum of the internet is filled with, like, half-truths and stuff, so it's like, to me, I just would merely like to, like, educate people, I think.
There is, I think, a desire to educate plays a part, and I think it plays a psychological part in us all. For instance, when you see someone assembling a model airplane, you can take any example, and you see that they're trying to put it together wrong, the tendency to correct that is there. Well, I think the same thing can be said philosophically. If we've been through a philosophical battle with ourselves on religion, and we have come to see that religion it doesn't offer what it promises, and its tenets are contradictory or nebulous and confusing, we tend to want to say, hey, you don't need that. And so there's a part of that, anyone who's remotely argumentative, there's a part of that that factors into things. Some of us are more argumentative than others, and that tends to factor into it as well. And sometimes that makes for these claims of animosity. Why are you trying to deconvert us? Why do you want to see Christianity fall? Why are you trying to bankrupt religions? Well, it's not about that. It's about truth, and it's about, as we said, making our experiences available to those who want to learn.
Right. Just speaking about misunderstanding atheism, a lot of people see atheism as a depressing and bitter or hateful outlook on life. What would you say to people like that who think that way about atheism?
To the idea that all the atheists have a bitter outlook on life?
Yeah, that the whole idea of atheism is just depressing, bitter, and hateful.
Well, and I perhaps have a little bit of a unique take on that. First of all, I'll say that it's untrue. The idea that life is miserable to all atheists is patently false and just ridiculous.
Right.
Many of the atheists I run into and talk to, that I'm friends with and communicate with by email almost every day, have an absolutely different outlook on life. They go through life and they don't go around fighting in their heads about whether or not Jesus is real. They don't go around grunting at people. And no, they're just as happy as the next person.
Right.
And we could take a handful of Christians and look at them and see who's more of a bitter person. And we might very well find that any given group of believers could be more bitter pound for pound than their atheist counterparts. And so as far as whether or not how a person's outlook on life is, that changes with or without religion. You're going to find a lot of negative and bitter atheists, and you're going to find those who are not. But there won't be a correlation of these certain people who are atheists are life haters and God haters and just people that just go through, you know, who are just angry. That's one of the biggest misconceptions.
Right.
But on the same hand, a person like myself, I tend to be one of those who tend to gravitate toward the negative, some would say. Mm. I tend to be a person who's a feudalist, a fatalist, someone who tends to see the negative more often. But that is to say nothing about general outlook,
right,
and the happiness of life. And there are different types of happiness anyway. There is a drug-induced happiness, a drunken euphoria, and then there is a mature happiness, satisfaction. So when you talk about atheists, and we talk about believers, and we talk about happiness and contentment, hey, we're talking about a big group there, and that there'll be all different types, just like there'll be all different types of Christians.
Right, exactly. Just like a lot of Christians say, well, that Christian gives Christianity a bad name. And I guess the same goes for really any religion or philosophy on life. There's bad examples for every part.
And this, may I say, gets back to the misconceptions that people keep having about atheism. And I have written articles on it, and others have, but apparently not enough. The idea that atheists are a group, and the idea that there are atheists who reflect negatively on other atheists, it doesn't work like that. An atheist may be a child pornographer murderer with 10 gigabytes of kiddie porn on his computer.
Right.
Or an atheist may be a college professor with multiple doctorates, or he may be a humanitarian who spends his life giving out donations. So it depends on the person. All atheism connects to other atheists is a lack of belief.
Right.
And so now when we talk about Christians, we're talking about positive belief. We're talking about a claim that is altogether different from an atheist claim. It's a positive claim. And of course, you're going to have those who say, hey, look, this guy's not a very good Christian. Well, you can make those kind of generalizations, whereas you can't with atheists.
Right. And now that you mention that, as you state in your website, atheism only defines what a person doesn't believe and doesn't necessarily imply any moral standards. What do you think about humanism, and could that be the potential answer to this dilemma of how we are to portray ourselves positively to the rest of society?
Well, I think humanism, and it's just like any discussion of ethics or morality, it is, and it will. Mankind will be himself, so to speak. Mankind will average out, and morality, it's all going to come out in the wash. Man is going to be what he is. As far as striving for betterment of man, I believe the humanistic values, of course, are the ultimate aim. I do believe, however, that the reason religion has remained around, is still around today, is because mankind's not yet ready to reject all of the principles of supernaturalism, which is why we still see churches, which is why we still see synagogues and mosques.
Right.
Mankind has not yet grown away from the childish ideas of the past. And I hate to say that, but it is nonetheless true. Reason for the humanist is a sufficient basis for morality.
Right.
When we go around and when we do good, we find it in ourselves to do good. We do that because we believe it is the right thing to do. Believers, however, don't operate the same way. They operate, well, I'm going to do good because a deity told me to do good, because there's a pair of eyes watching from the sky, and I need to help this person. I need to help this person because someone's compelling me to do it. Whereas humanistic values, of course, are altogether different. You do good because you find it in yourself to do good, because it is part of your nature to do good. And if it isn't, you don't do it.
Exactly.
It's a very simple thing. And so when we deal with ethics and morality, we're talking about something that is where God is altogether not necessary. And in my article, featured on my site, on morality, I even deal with the fact that whether a thing is right or wrong has no bearing on whether or not a God exists. If a God exists, it doesn't make a thing more right or if he doesn't exist, he doesn't make it more wrong. Those are things that are determined with human wisdom and with reason.
Right.
And but we have people that aren't thinking that way. We have large segments of society that believe that a thing is right if a deity says it's right. And if a deity says it's wrong, then it's not, then the thing is wrong. Well, like I said, unfortunately, we're not yet ready, society as a whole, not yet ready for accepting humanistic values. We're getting there, we're getting closer, and man is close, but we've still got a ways to go.
Right.
Yeah, I tend to find that a lot of people think these holy books are, these are the instructions from gods, and these are definitions of morality, and they think that without, instruction, we have no morality, and because we're atheists, we have no morals, or that we have no definition of morality, and if religion was wiped from the face of the earth, we would be lost without it, but I really don't think that's true.
As Voltaire put it, be careful of one who prides himself in great morals. Is someone who comes on and says, well, I can define morality. I have a certain morality. What they're saying is, well, look, I have a great big house, and the house is very secure, and no one can break in. Well, that may be true, but it's still just it's a false security. And it's the same thing with this Bible-based morality. You have people that use holy books, and they say, well, my morality has a foundation. Well, it's amazing how these foundations, supposedly immovable, are always changing through the years. The oppression of women, the slavery and the biblical mandates on slavery, which were hotly debated and even supported up until pretty recently, and even segregation. During the period of segregation, you had the believers who were fronting this oppressive group, and supposedly, and all of a sudden, everybody changes, and they say, well, Christianity teaches freedom of slaves. Christianity teaches kindness to women. Well, it's amazing how all these moral truths keep changing with the centuries and with the times. And yet we're told that a book written in the Bronze Age is the be-all and end-all of truth and thought. Well, that's a problem for a lot to be concerned about. But it's simply bogus as far as offering morality. No, the times and the reason of man offer us morality. When this silliness, this religious silliness that we're hearing about, goes through a different period of time, well, it changes. And then as people change, they make their religion to change.
Right.
And we can consider evolution as another example of that. All throughout the centuries of the dark years of the church, evolution and science were ridiculed and put on the back burner, and now all of a sudden, evolution is confronted, and the Christians come out and say, well, you know what, there never really was any conflict between science and religion. God ensouled an ape and turned him into a man, and that was the real Adam. Adam was an ape of sorts. It's just laughable.
Right. Basically, God evolves with man.
Exactly. God preferred the company of reptiles and amphibians for millions of years, and then suddenly he said, you know what, I want someone who's like me.
Right.
And very comical.
Not to mention the sort of the way of life that those animals lived, which was pretty brutal. And
exactly.
I think, I can't remember who described it, I think it was Dawkins or Hitchens, they were talking about that, how... for millions of years, God just stood back and watched as, the animal ate the smaller animal and kill or be killed sort of mentality. And then just out of the blue, I just thought, you'd make
exactly.
Man.
Exactly. So. That played a role in my deconversion was I could turn on the Discovery Channel as a believer, sit there at night and look at a TV and see a cheetah chasing down a gazelle.
Right.
And say to myself, that is so wrong. It's something that... If any man did that, if any scientist had the ability to, let's say, clone a type of life and then turn it into a predator-prey relationship, then he would be strung up, for cruelty. That's just the most horrible thing. But God does it, and God gets a pass on it. He does it in nature. He sets up an entire system where the weak are weeded out and are killed. And right. We're supposed to look at humanity and say, you know what, we need to be moral, we need to be human, because Jesus would want us to be human. And yet the architect of the universe himself creates a kill or be killed system where all the creatures on this planet except one kill and slaughter the weak.
Right.
The irony there is thick.
Just talking a little bit more about morality, in your site you mentioned a phrase called contract behavior as a way of explaining where morality comes from. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, I have read a number of treatises on humanist values and morality, and many of them I was not satisfied. When I wrote that article, and I have, by the way, a much more expanded version of that article, I made it into a chapter in my coming book.
Okay.
Contract behavior is a very simple arrangement, and it's just all the higher animals have it, and it's just a way of referring to agreements that animals make with themselves, up to and including humans. In the case of a baboon or a chicken, it would be different, and of course with a human being, it would be different. But what the contract behavior arranges is the way to make a society work out. For instance, a troop of baboons will automatically understand that not only is theft and murder being the out-of-place taking of life,
right,
a defined term, not only is that wrong, but it can't be any other way because society can't survive without it. Now, the baboon doesn't know that. The baboon just instinctively operates based on reason and says, here's what we must do. Furthermore, if the baboon sees, not older baboon, sees a group of leopards coming after their young, what they will do is they will sacrifice themselves for the sake of their troop. Well, they didn't need 10 commandments to come to that conclusion. They didn't need anything but reason.
Exactly.
And they did so because what was at stake was survival. So contract behavior is, it runs across every culture, it runs across every species, every species of higher animal, whether it's lions or anything else. It's just a way of saying, look, there are certain things that have to be in order to make a society work.
Right. There's like
that's the nature of that.
Just like an unspoken, innate agreement.
And that's what makes it an objective standard. And by the way, that's what I mean. When I say objective morality, I'm referring to contract behavior-based morality. I'm not referring to whether or not an ideology is correct. For instance, whether or not the Western philosophy is correct versus jihadist or Sharia law. That's a thing that is disputed amongst animals, human animals with big brains who debate. Mm-hmm. We're talking about things that all societies must have in some form to survive. You can't have murder. You can't have rape. You can't have theft. Now, sometimes you see variations in that law, but you don't see absence of that law because
right,
the society won't survive without it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And actually, Derek, you're reading that book that sort of centers around what we're talking about. It's called Evolving God.
Yeah, Evolving God by Barbara King.
I've heard of that.
She did a study on 8 behavior patterns and how they show like empathy and different humanistic style emotions. And she starts from there and branches out and basically talks about how the human mind developed religion and the idea of supreme being out of basic primitive mental functions, I guess. It's really interesting stuff.
Interesting. That'll go on my growing wish list of books.
Oh, yeah, we have a ton of wish list books that we want also.
Just to change the topic a bit, it's usually the Christian moderates who say that you're taking the Bible out of context and you lose its real message by not looking at the comprehensive whole. What's your take on that?
That is probably the biggest joke of all, is Christian moderates and Christian liberals of
right,
different ranks who claim to believe the Bible and yet pervert its teachings are violating not only common sense, but not only hermeneutics, but common sense. But they're taking everything that the Bible stood for and all, everything that the ancients believed about it, they're throwing it out the window. Let's take the example of the age of the earth.
Right.
God creating the earth in 6 literal days. Well, that is what Genesis teaches. Now, you get all these contemporary Christians who say, well, it doesn't have to be looked at that way. You can look at it as a moral guide. You can look at it as any type of book you want. You can look at the resurrection story of Jesus and you can say, you know, well, that's just a message of life over death. We should strive to have happy lives.
Right.
Sure, you can look at it that way, but that adulterates the meaning of what the author all you have to do is go back to history and look at what you interpreted Genesis 1. And then from there, the early church fathers up to our present time.
Mm.
Well, it was always literal. You didn't have people contesting, saying, well, how long were the days of Genesis? You didn't have that because it wasn't necessary. The meaning was very clear. God created the earth in 6 days. People come up with these arguments and say, well, a day meant a billion years or something like that. You have to go back and read that into the text.
Right.
And the only way you can do that is if you have an agenda, a modern agenda, like contemporaries do. They say, well, you know what? I want the Bible to be relevant today, and I want it to withstand criticism. So therefore, I'm going to go back to the Bible, and I'm going to try to pick apart things that I can use and say, aha, that's divinity. That's divine inspiration. But the rest, well, you're interpreting it wrong.
Right.
Well, my response to those people, to modern contemporaries, I don't take them seriously. My response is, go back to what the authors originally intended to convey, the message they intended to convey, and accept that message.
Mm.
And if by accepting it you find that it's not compatible with science, that it's not compatible with morality, as in the case of the imprecatory Psalms and the massacres of the Israelites in Numbers 31 and different passages, if you find that you can't make that jive with what we know is decent, good, and true today, then you reject it.
Right.
And that's what I did. I was raised in a fundamentalist church. And while I am criticized for as being a part of a blind fundamentalist who never saw anything different, that wasn't true either. I did see it, but I realized that we have to draw only those conclusions that are warranted by the evidence. And when we go to interpret a Bible passage or passages, we have to understand that the message that is being conveyed has to be the message we are reading. I can't read something into the text.
Right.
And so that's what I would like. So when I hear these people who say, well, you're not taking from the Bible what you should be taking, my reply is no, it's just the other way around. It's you're putting in the Bible what is not there
right.
for the sake of making it fit a modern generation that it does not fit.
Right, exactly. And basically they're editing the Bible to fit a more reasonable outlook on the Bible itself. And like you said, they say you're misinterpreting it or it's not meant to be taken literally when the Bible isn't always obvious about what's literal and what's not. So leaving it up to the average believer to figure it out is really potentially a dangerous thing. And I actually think that it could be better for modern Christians to do the same thing that Marcion did, which one of the earlier Christians, he just took out the whole Jewish part of the Bible and just said, let's use just the Gospel of Luke and Paul's epistles. And I think if Christian moderates are going to do this, just take out all the bad stuff. Just take it out and then make it, you know, a better Bible, which might actually benefit people in some way.
Well, and now I'll go further with that. I wrote an article on this, and the title of the article is "The Line Must Be Drawn Here," and it's I go into the fact that if you want to make a new God who conforms to the morality of the 21st century,
right.
hey, just drop the either take what is there, what little is there in the Bible that is not grotesque and cruel and bizarre and false, or get rid of it all and start again. Why use the name Yahweh, who was a tribal war god, and say, well, this God today wants you to clasp your hands when you sit at your dinner table and pray for people like Pat Robertson and the Christian right. Well, that's what God wants you to do. the dishonesty in that and the silliness in that is just beyond words. The idea that God fits a new generation of technology and freedom of expression, no, it doesn't fit. So if you're going to make a new God, just call him something else. Don't use the name of a tribal war god and say, well, this God, he changed today. He wants peace and he wants kindness.
Right.
It doesn't fit.
Yeah, definitely. But Derek, did you have like any questions you wanted to ask?
Back to the Holy Ark creationists and stuff, and obviously living in Texas, I've noticed a lot of people. There's a place I think in Texas that has a footprint of a dinosaur, and right next to them they think that they're footprints of a human, and just up near Canyon Lake they opened a whole new fossil thing, and they have, you know, those young earth creationists out there saying that dinosaurs and humans walked hand in hand. Do you ever run into people like that? And like, if you ever get in discussions, do you ever, like, I mean, how do you handle stuff like that in discussions?
Well, if you're referring to the Poughkeepsie Riverbed man
yes.
tracks?
Yes.
Okay, yes, I'm familiar with those. Matter of fact, I took our church as a minister to the Glen Rose Creation Museum with so-called doctor, put it in quotes there, mm-hmm. Carl Baugh. of the Creationist Museum, and it was quite a joke. I was there at the time, and even then I was starting to question what I believe. I said, you know what, this is really crazy, and this just isn't jiving with anything I'm learning. And I wasn't ready to defect at the time, but I was already having problems with it. I said, this is bizarre. Well, I investigated so-called man tracks because I was a literal creationist and believed in a 6,000-year-old Earth, and had contempt for science. But in time, of course, I threw that off. But in answer to your question, first of all, when dealing with, I don't get contacted as much by literalists, super literalists anymore. I do occasionally get an email from someone who believes in a 6,000-year-old Earth who tries to use this or that verse, and they'll point out, hey, you know, there were dinosaurs coexisting with man. It's completely bogus. The man tracks, so-called man tracks, while some of them do look like human feet, they are not human feet. They don't have the arch, they don't have certain muscles, and of course many of them are just outright forgeries by Baugh and others in the creation science movement who have literally made up fossils from nothing. And
yeah.
that's a whole subject for another time, let me tell you. But in debating literalist creationists, I don't debate them. And the reason is because when you debate, I agree with Richard Dawkins on this when he says, when you debate a creationist, what you're doing is you're saying that his view is on footing with your view. So you don't want to give time to a person like Kent Hovind or Carl Ball, because to do so is to imply that there's a debate and to deceive people who are not learned on the subject. If you listen to Kent Hovind and you don't understand anything about evolution and you're a religious mind, a religious thinker, then you're likely to be deceived by it and to be pulled in by it because, hey, some of it sounds stupid. Some of Christian science sounds like it makes sense if you don't understand real stuff. And so that ends up being a problem for some. But, no, I don't debate it. I don't give time to it. There's just so many bigger things to debate than the idea that the Earth is 6,000 or 10,000 years old. I still get people once in a while that reach out, but more so people are reaching out today with the idea that, like we mentioned a moment ago, that Adam was an ape. And God created a lot of creatures and then suddenly just turned around and said, you know what, I'm going to make creatures like me. And so here's man. That has become a lot more prominent.
Right.
But both views, totally unlivable.
And Derek, that's sort of the same way of thinking that you're going with talking to people through email about evolution. You know, like what's the first thing you ask them to do?
Define evolution and what scientific theory means. To me, like, I have them do that before we even discuss evolution, because a lot of times they don't even understand what the basic fundamentals of it are, and they're taking a creationist standpoint and trying to argue with me. But if they don't even understand what evolution is. They're never going to be able to establish a point with me, so.
Unless they are willing to accept the naturalistic premise in some form, unless they can let reason take center stage, which they don't, they can't make sense of it. They're just going to fall back to, hey, you know, God did it. That's all creation, quote, science is. It's just God did it. Like Michael Shermer says, you know, what does it tell you? It doesn't tell you, it tells you God did it.
Right.
You use all that science, and the science that to Christians is window dressing. It just brings you to the conclusion, hey, God did it. It offers nothing substantive.
I agree.
Yeah, and it's funny because that actually will be the end of the discussion sometimes. Sometimes he'll tell them to go actually find out what evolution means in scientific theory, and that'll be it. He'll never hear from them again. So that might actually be a promising sign. All right, Joe, if you could actually just let us know when your book is coming out and tell us a little bit about it.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, Project Bible Truth, A Minister Turned Atheist and Tells All will be the title. And, of course, it will focus on my deconversion from Christianity. It will range from the time I converted to Christianity and why I slowly affected. It will also contain a layman's read look on the evidences for my rejection of Christianity. It's got some satire, and it's got even a little poetry, some different expressions of a minister turning atheist in it. It's going to be available January, looks like the 10th of 2008, so it is
awesome.
Just right around the corner, and as we speak, in fact, I am rushing as fast as can be to take care of some final editing changes and get that to work. But it shall be out soon.
Wow, that's great. And I think that it's really interesting to include those different styles of writing, because you usually don't see that in a lot of atheist books that are coming out right now.
That is very true. It will be no question of it, a standalone as far as content and originality. And hopefully writing as well, but I don't know. We'll have to see. So.
Yeah, well, I definitely enjoy the content on your site, and I look forward to reading the book. And as soon as it comes out, we'll be sure to add a link on our site so everyone else can check it out too.
All right, sounds great.
All right, well, thanks a lot for taking the time to talk with us today. We'll make sure everyone out there checks out ministerturnsatheist.org for any updates on the book and any new content. And I appreciate your time, Joe.
All right, thanks, Adam.
Thanks, you have a great night.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Well, that's it. We had a few technical difficulties, but I think came out pretty good for the most part. Thanks for listening, and as always, keep following the path of reason.